invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. It was not such a pleasure to get here. On my way, I discovered that, well, at least according to United, there are all these sort of turbulent events in the atmosphere. And a lot of these turbulent events in the atmosphere on my way over prevented me from arriving here to see a talk on turbulence yesterday. So having not seen that, I hope there's not too much overlap between what I'm going to tell you and that. If there is, please tell me and we'll be able to adjust as we go along. But I don't think there'll be too much overlap, because although I'll tell you a little bit at the end about simulations and quantum fluids, most of what I'm going to tell you about is experiments in real fluids, in viscous fluids, and they're sort of represented by this picture over here. So what you see here is a picture taken in my lab in a big aquarium, essentially. And it's a photograph, and what you see in this photograph are sort of bubbles. Okay, that's a bit of a mess, but you can see that a lot of them are sort of organized in these filamentous structures. These are, in fact, vortices. They're concentrated lines of vorticity in water. And the experiments which I'm going to tell you about, the aim of them was to take these vortex loops, these filamentous vortices, and tie them into knots and links and see what they do. And it's kind of hard to talk about this topic without paying homage to where the basic original idea that everything really came from, which is sort of Lord Kelvin. Okay? And there's a sort of nice story associated with this. Some of you might have heard it. The story goes that Lord Kelvin was attending some lectures, and part of these lectures was a demonstration. The lectures were on circulation theorems. And one of these lectures, part of this lecture was a demonstration by Peter Guthrie Tate, a brilliant young scientist at the time. And this demonstration consisted of basically building a box and cutting a hole in this box and putting some smoke in this box and then pushing some of the air out of this box. And what happens when you do that is something like this. Okay, sort of you get smoke rings, essentially, that emerge from this phenomenon. Okay. Now, this, of course, is not Peter Guthrie Tate. This is another brilliant young scientist, Dustin Kleckner. Okay, who together with Martin Schiele, Dustin's a postdoc in my lab and Martin Schiele a graduate student, and together they're really responsible for a lot of the work that you're going to see today. Okay, so the story goes that there's this lecture, and this lecture is telling you that if you make vortex loops in a perfect fluid, they can never break. Okay? And this was, of course, a time in which the periodic table was known. Atoms as an idea were around, but nobody really had a good model for what they were. And it was also a time in which there was this idea that there's this sort of a superluminal ether that kind of permeates space everywhere and forms a perfect fluid. And so the story goes that Kelvin, who was looking for simple building blocks out of which to build complexity, okay, saw this spectacle and thought, aha, here's a simple object. It's just a loop. Right? It's a stable object. If I could introduce complexity, for example, by tying it into knots or linking them up, then I have a way of creating a structure which is permanent and stable, right? But which can be at the same time very complex, even though it's built out of a simple building block. So the idea was that atoms must be knots tied in vortices in the ether. Okay. Now, we sort of, you know, as everybody knows, that failed as a theory of atoms. Okay. But it really didn't fail at all as an idea. It was a very kind of powerful idea, and in many ways formed the sort of beginnings of the introduction of topological ideas in physics. And after a long period of incubation in mathematics, where it gave rise essentially to the field of knot mathematics, it's sort of come back in sort of many, many ways in physics. In fact, one of the ways in which it kind of developed into a field was because it inspired Peter Guthrie Tate to start to classify knots. So he kind of heard of this idea and was fascinated, so he started to classify knots to see if you could do this mapping. And he did this by hand, essentially. And once you had this sort of table of knots and classifications, then somebody had to try and kind of quantify it. Okay? Mathematicians wanted to give these things numbers, okay, to see how you could classify them. That's a problem which is still open. There is no number, unique number that you can give to a knot or a link that uniquely classifies it. Okay? But it kind of really kind of crystallized things. So there's a lot of mathematics that was developed to treat with this sort of thing, and it's come back into physics in many ways from all sorts of exotic field theories, all the way to kind of very real condensed matter systems. And one of the sort of modern contexts in which these ideas have returned is sort of complex dissipative flows, sort of the opposite regime of where Kelvin was thinking. And so here's, for example, a picture of a complex dissipative flow. This is a picture of kind of magnetic field lines with plasma flowing along them. This is a picture taken on the surface of the sun. This is a kind of, not really a picture, but a representation of turbulence in a classical fluid by Leonardo. And here's a sort of more recent kind of computer rendition of that. And here's a picture which you might well have seen yesterday. Okay, there's a sort of whole field of studying and trying to understand complex flows in quantum fluids in terms of turbulence in complex fluids in terms of these quantized vortices. And so the basic, you know, different systems, but the basic kind of set of difficult problems, of difficult questions. And so what do you sort of do when you encounter a very difficult problem in physics? Well, you know, you sort of call your friends, at least I try to, and your friends can be real people that you call, right? But your friends can also be basically your best friends when you're trying to solve a problem in physics are conserved quantities. They are kind of simple quantities which can give you a lot of insight into the problem. And so usually when you try to sort of think about these problems over here, you start asking immediately, what's the energy doing? What's the momentum doing? What's the angular momentum doing? And you can get quite far with these sort of ideas. But it would sort of be great if you could have additional conserved quantities which could guide the way you think about the problem. And the sort of modern incarnation of Kelvin's idea is that there is at least one more such conserved quantity, at least in ideal fluids, and that's the helicity. Okay? And this quantity was sort of discovered by Keith Moffat in the 70s. It's given by this quantity, by this expression over here. Okay, it's the integral of the velocity of the fluid dotted with the vorticity of the fluid integrated over space. As this sort of quantity, if you like, was discovered directly from the equations of motion and not from an underlying symmetry, you can sort of ask, well, how should I interpret it? How should I think about it? And one of Keith's insights was the right way to think about this quantity is in terms of the knottedness of the vortex lines in the fluid. So it's a quantity, I'll come back to this later on, but it's a quantity which measures the kind of knottedness of vortex lines in the fluid. And for a perfect fluid, for an ideal fluid, you can show that this is an exactly conserved quantity. The question, of course, is what happens in a real fluid? What happens as soon as you introduce a little bit of viscosity? Right? How can you sort of, does this quantity really survive? Is this a relevant quantity for real fluids? And so that's a kind of enticing question, and it's a question that's been around for a long time, but it's also a very difficult to resolve question because it's very hard to do any sort of analytical calculation where you look at kind of turbulent flow or sort of vortex reconnections or singular problems like that. So the only kind of real way, I think, to try to resolve this in a real fluid case is by experiment. And although these ideas have been around for a long time, it isn't until recently that we've been able to really kind of approach this sort of experiment for many reasons. A lot of them have to do with the fact that we just have new technology now that we didn't before. We can really visualize things in 3D. We can make things in 3D. Okay, I'll pass this around a little bit later. We can kind of analyze things in 3D in a way which we couldn't before. So it's a sort of a good time to jump in and study this problem. And yeah?
Does H quantify knottedness uniquely or?
Uniquely, no. If there were, yes, that would be almost tantamount to saying there's a unique measure of knottedness, which there most certainly isn't.
Some measure of knottedness.
It is some measure of knottedness. In fact, this is a measure of linkedness, which you can make into a measure of knottedness by making curves from curves. Okay. So we haven't really been able to approach this until recently, but now we sort of can. And what I'm going to tell you about are our experiments where we sort of try to approach this in the fluid context. We're of course not the only people to be thinking about knots in physical fields. Now that we can really do this, okay, there's all sorts of people thinking about it in different contexts. Here's an example. I won't talk about this today. This is actually sort of theoretical work in optical fields. This is experimental and theoretical work in optical fields in a different degree of freedom. Okay, this is the work I'm going to tell you about today. There's a lot of work being done on liquid crystals where people are sort of looking at the director field lines and knotting them and linking them and trying to use them to kind of study the physics of these systems. But one of the nice things about sort of being at the beginnings of a sort of experimental playground, if you like, is that any system you work in, you can whatever you learn, the basic tools that you develop in that field might well apply to the other fields. And so there's a lot of questions that surround all these problems from initial state design, their evolution and stability. You can sort of think of it, if you like, as a general problem of designing explicit topological structures and seeing what they do. Okay, so what we wanted to do was kind of try and think about the simplest way to try and test this idea of helicity conservation, the simplest way to kind of approach topology in a real fluid. And the simplest way that we could think of is to try and make a vortex knot a la Kelvin, but make it in a real fluid. And it kind of turns out that, in fact, even though Kelvin's idea dates back to about 100 years, nobody to date had ever managed to make a vortex knot in any real system. So of course, before you set out on trying to do something like that, you get very, very worried. Right? There must be a good reason why nobody's managed to make this before. You kind of panic a little bit. And just to sort of set the tone for a lot of what you're going to be seeing, a lot of my talk will be movies. Let me show you a movie that kind of actually had an impact on our thinking. This is a movie, a YouTube movie of our friends from the ocean making vortex rings. And what you can see is that these dolphins can sort of easily make these vortex loops. And they can make them very stable. They can play with them. They can sort of manipulate them. And this kind of really suggested that, you know, you sort of look at this and you think, okay, maybe it's difficult, but you should be able to take this and tie this into a knot. Okay. So as Dustin likes to put it, amongst his many talents as being a master of Photoshop, this talk is going to be about taking this and making it into this and this. Okay. So where do we begin? Okay. Well, the kind of first place that we began was the simplest one we could think of. Right? We've got these kind of loops. We know how to make loops. We could imagine, for example, taking these loops and shooting them at each other. And maybe if we do it in just the right way, we could get them to link up and form knots. Okay, this sort of simplest thing you can do. And in fact, we weren't the only people to think about this. There was a proposal as recent as 2010 by Renzo Ricca, who actually thought about this. And he said he actually had a whole scheme for how to do this. And his scheme consisted of making two vortex rings. These two vortex rings had to be deformed in just the right way. These are both traveling kind of into the board. And his idea was that, well, if you take these vortex rings and you shape them and time them just in the right way, they're going to connect with each other, and then they're going to form a knot. So what we set out to do was to sort of create all the ingredients that you need for the scheme over here. And I'm going to show you these steps, also because they allow us to kind of introduce a lot of the basic dynamics which underlie all the experiments. So the first thing is, of course, a ring. Okay? So you can make rings very easily. You can do this at home with a sort of box and smoke. Or if you have an aquarium, you could put a box inside your aquarium. That's what we did. This is just basically a box with a hole in it. And we use the speaker to push on this box and push fluid out of this orifice. But instead of having smoke in here, we had a few micro bubbles, which were generated by hydrolysis. And what you get when you do this is something that looks like this. So we're just pushing fluid out of this hole, and it forms this this kind of nice vortex ring.
So the micro bubbles decorate the vortex.
Yes. So the micro bubbles, they decorate the vortex. Okay. And the reason they do that is that sort of the right way to sort of think about this flow field. I mean, you're seeing bubbles, right? But really what's interesting here is that there's a whole three-dimensional flow field, and this flow field is organized by this ring. Okay? So the ring gives you the right way to think about the flow field, but whether or not the bubbles were there or not would make no difference to the physics of the flow field. Okay? And the way to think about this flow field is an irrotational flow field. There's sort of no vorticity everywhere in the flow field except along this line over here, where all the vorticity is concentrated. And so if you'd like to sort of, if you have a loop of concentrated vorticity, okay, it's related to the velocity in just the same way as a magnetic field is related to a current. Okay? So once you know where these rings are, you can visually reconstruct the entire flow field, right, by just using a magnetic analogy. You know how to sort of guess a magnetic field from a wire, right? Well, the flow field from the vortex loop is just the same as the magnetic field would be from the equivalent wire. So what we know is that the magnetic field around the wire kind of rotates around this wire. So the fluid is spinning around the wire. And that tells you immediately why the bubbles go to the center of the vortex loop. Okay? If you have fluid that's spinning around and you have something that's lighter than the fluid around, it's going to be buoyant and it's going to go to the center of rotation. And that's how you get this nice tracing of the vortex. Okay. So that's a ring, okay? But we sort of knew how to do rings before. Let me show you now. The other ingredient that we needed was to be able to make multiple rings and have them interact with each other. So what I'm going to show you now is a video where we made two rings, and we fired them one after the other in this direction over here. And this is kind of nice because it allows you, amongst other things, to get a feel for how vortices interact, but also illustrates one of the basic laws of vortex motion. Like, the basic law of vortex motion is that a vortex moves, it's just transported by flow. Okay, and that's basically, if you want to know how a vortex moves, you calculate the flow, and the flow just transports the vortex. So what you've seen over here is that the first ring that has this sort of flow that's going around it like this, as the second ring gets close to it, captures the second ring and transports it in its flow. And then, if you like, the second ring captures the first ring and transports it in its flow. And they kind of dance around each other for as long as they can. So that's sort of that's the other ingredient we needed. We needed two. The other thing which we needed was to be able to make shape. Okay, so here's our kind of first example of making shape. Here's a hole, and it's not a circle anymore. This is kind of a distorted hole. And what you find is that this is actually really, really easy to do. And you know, if you ever sort of playing around making lecture demonstrations of vortices, okay, and you want to sort of shake it up a little bit, you can make a hole like this. It'll work really nicely. Okay. But what you see is that what you get from this hole is a really nice kind of coherent evolution of the vortex. Right? It sort of looks as if it's oscillating coherently and propagating and maintaining its structure. And in fact, this kind of motion almost looks elastic, right? But it's not really elastic. To understand it, you can understand it in terms of the one basic law of vortex evolution, which is that vortices are transported by the flow. Okay? So how can we use that to understand this? Well, if you we don't have a second vortex, so it's just the flow generated by the one vortex, which matters. If your vortex was a straight line, the flow would just be spinning around it. It wouldn't transport it at all. It would just sit there. But as soon as you curve this line, right, then if you like, at any one point, the neighboring points are generating a flow, which is influencing this point. And this flow is proportional, is exactly the same flow. You can calculate it, if you like, mentally by thinking of it as a magnetic field generated by the wire. So you know that it diverges as you approach the core. And the fact that the flow field diverges as you approach the kind of edge of this vortex tells you that the only contribution is local. Right? And so that gives you, and the only sort of local parameter that matters is the curvature of the vortex. So that gives you a sort of direct translation of the basic law of vortex motions for curved vortices, which is that curved vortices move in the direction of perpendicular to the local curvature and proportional to the local curvature. So these segments over here are more curved, so they're going to go faster. These segments are straight, so they're not going to move very much. And these segments are sort of almost anti-curved, so they're going to go backwards. And so now you can see how this part over here comes down ahead of the others. These parts over here come back and come back. And that's what organizes this evolution. And you can sort of really see this if you look at the flow field from the side. OK.
It's almost a periodic motion, since we're reconstructing the original shape and then.
Yes. But it's all just coming from this law of local induction. That's the intuition. Okay? Quantitatively, local induction, not very good. But qualitatively, very, very good as a way of understanding the vortex motion. Okay, so we sort of have the ingredients which we need. We can make shape, we can make multiple ones, we can, you know, even think about colliding them, and so we have everything we need to implement Renzo Ricca's scheme. Okay. And I could show you a lot more movies like this, but to make a very long story short, we tried this for a long time, and what we found is essentially it's a complete disaster. We tried shooting vortices from all sorts of angles. We tried Renzo's scheme. We tried a million things, and we just couldn't get it to work. In fact, what we discovered after trying all this was that many, many people had before us had also tried to do this and also hadn't quite managed to get a vortex to knot up. And so we were sort of, at this point, kind of thinking, well, you know, maybe there's a fundamental reason why we can't do this. Maybe this is just a really bad approach. And we don't know, because we don't know really what the answer is. We don't know that it's impossible that way. But I can speculate that if what you're sort of trying to do is test the conservation law that tells you that knottedness is conserved, then taking two things that are not knotted and have no topology and smashing them into each other, well, it's not really going to give you topology.
Okay. You have a movie of the failure?
I have about 1,000 movies of failures. I guess that maybe next time I'll show one. But yeah, this is a tough time in the lab. Okay, so if we're not going to do it in the middle of the fluid, because we suspect maybe there's some conservation that gets in the way, well, maybe we can make it at the edge of the fluid. So maybe we can make a hole where the edge of the hole is a knot. Okay? And so this is our attempt at this. Okay? We had many, many more attempts, but this was number 8. Okay? The idea is that this is basically a hole, and you can push the fluid through this hole. You can bolt this onto the same tank. And the edge of this hole that has this little lip over here traces the edge of a trefoil knot. And so, of course, now we're kind of explicitly engineering the vortex. We need to choose a detailed shape, not just a topological shape. So for that, we sort of went back to, in fact, what is the only kind of really kind of closed form analytical theory that we know in this game, which was a beautiful paper by Shigeo Kida, who had found particular shapes of vortex knots that, if they move under this assumption of local induction, maintain their shape, okay, and just simply rotate and translate. And so they should be stable forever. So that's the shape that we took. Okay, and we did a lot of experiments. This one is number 9. And this is what we got. It's kind of also a bit of a disaster. Or not. Right? This is actually where you find out in your lab who's an optimist, who's a pessimist, and stuff like that. Okay, so some of them are sort of like, This is fantastic. This works really, really well. Look, you know, every time that we kind of try to print this vortex, look, we get this nice curve over here. We get this nice curve over here. It's working really exactly, you know, everywhere it should. And they're right. The problem is that then the sort of pessimist comes along and says, yeah, okay, it's working so well, it's working even where it shouldn't work. And where it shouldn't work is on the other side of this lip over here. Right? You want it to work on this lip, but you don't want it to work over here. So then the real pessimist comes along and says, ah, this is not a hole with an edge with a knot. This is 4 holes, and they're just pointed at each other. This is doomed from the beginning. Okay.
Sorry, did you machine this or bought it?
We 3D print these things. 3D print. Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's one of the developments that made all this possible. OK, so why am I showing you this second failure? This is the last failure I'm going to show you. I'm showing it to you because it's an interesting failure, and it kind of pointed us in the right direction. Why is it interesting? Well, because the way in which it works is kind of a very fundamental, in which it does not work, is a sort of very fundamental one. It works everywhere you break symmetry. You have open and closed. And it fails everywhere you don't break symmetry. You have open and open. But if you want to make a hole whose edge traces a knot, right, you're always going to have crossings, and that's always going to force you to have to go from a region of open, closed to open and open. Right? So if you want to ever have a chance at doing this, you need to invent an object breaks symmetry and is open on both sides. And that was kind of the, if you like, the ingredient that was missing in the thinking before. The object that does that is a very familiar one, and it's one that sort of brought us all here together for this conference. It's a wing. You can sort of think about the flow around the wing, okay? So we all sort of know that the flow around the wing consists of fluid moving faster over the top than the bottom, modulo all sorts of dodgy explanations that people kind of project in high school, that the end result of is that. Okay, so you can think about this flow as the superposition of a steady flow and a vortex flow that's rotating around this wing. Okay, and that's in fact sort of the right way to think about flow around the wing. And if you like, you know, you might wonder, well, why should I be thinking about stuff going over and around the wing? There's no real vortex there. The fluid isn't going back. You know that this is sort of the right way to think about flow around the wing because it has a physical manifestation. Whenever you take a wing and you make it finite in length instead of making it infinitely long, right, then you see that this vortex which is going around the wing wants to carry on, wants to continue. You get these wingtip vortices that kind of come off the edge of the airplane. So the right way to think about flow around the wing is really as a vortex that's bound to your wing, superposed with your motion. But now, of course, this is kind of all good and well as long as you're flying along. When you're sitting on the runway, you don't have any such vortex bound to your wing. You have no flow at all, in fact. So somehow, when you accelerate, you have to produce this vortex. You have to produce this circulation. And one of the things that the sort of Kelvin circulation theorems tell you is that you can't just do that willy-nilly in the middle of a fluid. You have to sort of balance it. You have to conserve. If you generate circulation, you have to balance it. And so the way in which a wing does this is at the moment of acceleration, it emits a vortex which has the opposite circulation and balances the circulation which is bound to the wing. And so the idea was, if we could take a wing, okay, and then we could tie this wing into a ring, okay, then by accelerating it, we should be able to produce a vortex that way. And this is kind of known physics. The starting vortex is known physics. We didn't quite know if you could use it as a technique to pattern vorticity. So the first thing we tried was just a ring. So this is our CAD model of a ring. This is how we produce, in fact, all the structures that I'm going to show you today. We sort of 3D print it. This is a time lapse. This takes about maybe 10 hours or so. But you can produce this thing, and then you can mount it. So here it is mounted inside a tank. There's a few bubbles, which we've coded on the surface of this ring. And what I'm going to show you now, what happens is when you accelerate this thing down, and what you see is that when you accelerate this thing down, exactly what you expect happens. It produces a vortex of opposite circulation, but then propagates backwards.
So do people see when a swimmer dives?
Yes, you get all sorts of transients coming off. It's very hard to see in airplanes, except maybe if you look at some of these videos of like really fast airplanes, like landing, where this acceleration is very strong. It's really an acceleration-driven effect. Okay? If you do this smoothly, it doesn't really work. You need to accelerate impulsively and go from one velocity to another velocity, and that's when you kick out this vortex. Okay, so you know you can test also. You can do all sorts of quantitative stuff on this. It works just fine, but that's not the point. The point is, we now have this object which breaks symmetry and is open on both sides. Right? So now we can try to think about doing something like this and see if this really works to generate, to solve our problem of making a knot. And so what I want to show you now is the first non-failure of this talk. Okay? It's a little bit hard to see, right? Because it's a little bit shaded. It's not our best image, but it's our favorite image because it's the first time that we got this experiment to work. So here is our wing tied into a knot. We accelerated into the board. And that's what we see when you do that. I'll just show that again.
The support struts weren't going to create any...
No, it wasn't obvious at all. Nothing in this process was obvious to us.
So you did try to minimize the number of supports that you needed?
Yes.
It looks like you've got a lot of support. Yes.
We've since managed to economize on support. I'll pass this around in a minute. In fact, I can pass this around now. This is an example of what you've just seen, right? This is one of these... hydrofoils, which we accelerate this way over here, with a slightly different strut configuration. As I said, this was a really early days video that I showed you. Now, of course, I've kind of drawn the knot over here. You could sort of believe me, but some of you might want to really, you know, knots are really three-dimensional things. They're not two-dimensional things. So to really convince you that this is a vortex knot, we had better measure it in 3D. And so to do this, we sort of developed, if you like, conceptually very simple apparatus where you take a laser sheet and you scan it back and forth over the knot, and you take pictures at the same time synchronized with this, and then you can reconstruct from all the slices the three-dimensional shape of the vortex. And the tricky thing is, of course, to do this fast enough to capture the dynamics of the vortex, but that's actually, you know, we managed to do that. So we record, just to give you an idea, we record images at about 100,000 images per second, and that gives us about 500 volumetric data sets per second. And these volumetric data sets really just simply come from reconstructing the kind of slices and making it into 3D data. So what that allows you to do is to then kind of take your vortex knot and, whoops. Aha. Ah. This is the danger of using a new computer to give a talk. This vortex knot was supposed to sort of rotate nicely around and dance for you. So let me see if I can make this happen. Movie. Oh, tragic. Okay. Oh well. It's important to set things up properly. Okay. So if my movie were working, and I'll try to get you a movie later on, it is working. Okay, I could now take this thing and rotate it in three dimensions, and you'll be able to see the three-dimensional structure of this vortex now. Okay, so good. So we have a technique sort of for making vortex knots. It's kind of a technique that in principle is a little bit more general. But one of the first things that we sort of asked is, well, okay, so all these other approaches kind of didn't work. So what's going on? Why does this one work? Right? And we don't really know why this was, you know, again, I'm speculating a little bit. But perhaps one of the reasons why this works is that it doesn't violate any of these conservation rules. And the reason it doesn't violate any conservation rules is that we've sort of generated this vortex knot, which you see over here. Okay? But in fact, that would appear to generate knottedness out of nothing in some sense. But in fact, by the very technique that sort of makes this thing over here, what you know is that you don't just generate actually a vortex knot. What you generate is a vortex knot over here, but you also generate a vortex which is bound to the wing. If you like, one way to think about this is that you're making a vortex knot and you're making a vortex anti-knot and you're ripping them apart. So there's no kind of change in anything topological in this process. Okay. So so from just a sort of strictly experimental point of view, this is sort of nice because now we think we have a technique for patterning arbitrary vorticity in three dimensions. And so you can think about making all sorts of shapes, all sorts of topologies. And that's one of the things that we're pursuing very actively at the moment. Of course, the end goal, the sort of acid test of all this is was gonna be, if you like, is defined by science fiction or whatever you think of the Lord of the Rings. Okay. What our goal is in this kind of strand of the research is to be able to do something like this. Okay, well, this is easy. This is not so hard. What we would really like to be able to do is what Gandalf so nicely does, is to be able to pattern any vortex shape and see if we can do that. That's the goal, right? It's not that's science fiction or whatever, you know, whatever Lord of the Rings is. Okay. So, you know, so before we get too excited about sort of new techniques and stuff, one of the things that you want to do when you have a new technique is you want to kick it. You want to sort of kick the tires and see if it works or what's going on. So so the first thing that we did was to sort of perturb it a little bit. You know, were we lucky just with that one particular shape? So we started making these things on very different scales, and we started accelerating them to different speeds and making them different shapes. And we took a lot of videos that look like this and sort of. And one of the things that we wanted to do is see if this kind of basic understanding of generating circulation around the wing, being balanced by the opposite circulation, is really what's going on, the right way to think about it. So we wanted to do scaling, which is what you sort of usually do in fluids in these circumstances. But we weren't quite sure how to do scaling, and then we sort of just realized that, because there isn't a sort of simple number that you can extract from this whole vortex that you can then kind of plot on the y-axis against an x-axis to do your scaling. But what we realized is that, in fact, it is, you know, you can actually capture this whole 3D information by just using scaling it appropriately using two numbers. Okay? So what characterizes the strength of a vortex is just the circulation. Okay? And the circulation has units of length squared over time. The other characteristic kind of length in the problem is the overall size of the vortex, and that's a length. And so by using these two, you can come up with a time, right, which is sort of length squared over gamma, and you can come up with a length. And so what you can do is you can then take the entire three-dimensional trace of the vortex and scale it in this way. So these are different runs at different Reynolds numbers, different experiments, rescaled according to the same time, and you can see that they kind of different sizes, but their shapes match very closely. If you also rescale them by the characteristic size, you see that you get very good collapse. So this kind of suggests that the technique is working more or less as you expect. Okay. So the next question that you ask is, of course, is this really general? Can we just make a knot, or can you make other topologies? And so we tried to make the next kind of simplest atom, if you like, which is a pair of linked rings. Okay. And here we go. Please, this one run beyond this point. Yes, okay. So now I can really show you this thing in 3D, what I couldn't do with the knot. And this also sort of shows that you can use this to make other topologies. Okay, but the reason we're sort of doing all this is really to see what happens to topological vortices after you've made them, to ask what happens next, essentially. And that's what the rest of this talk is gonna be about. So remember, the shapelet we made these things was supposed to have this idealized evolution where this thing kind of rotates and translates and doesn't change shape. So what do we see? Well, let's look at it head on. The first thing that you see is that it rotates a little bit, looks promising. But then as soon as you sort of really start looking at the rest, you find that the next, you know, time steps completely destroy that whole evolution for the idealized case. This thing changes shape. It changes shape very dramatically. In fact, it changes shape in a very sort of ominous way. Different strands start to approach each other and get closer and closer and closer. In fact, what you see is that these different strands get closer and closer, and they approach each other so close that they eventually just reconnect with each other and break this knot into two separate rings. And here's a zoom in of this process. So this is our vortex knot evolving. Okay. No quantum fluctuations here. Okay. So Maybe we should. So there's going to be a questionnaire at the end of this talk, by the way. I think I can predict your score. Okay. So reconnections. So this thing evolves, okay, the things approach each other and they unlink. And they essentially kind of take this nice knot that's supposed to live forever and they break it up. Here's a kind of view of the full evolution without zooming in anywhere. And here's a sort of cartoon so you can sort of, you know what the dynamics are. So again, you know, this is when you find out who's pessimist, who's optimist, and stuff like that. One of the first questions is, of course, is this peculiar to this shape? Is this peculiar to this knot? And the answer is it's not. It seems to be a very general feature of topological vortices. Here's what link rings do. Okay? And we tried many other shapes. Right? And essentially, every time we have topology, we see something like this. So what's going on? As I said, this is sort of where the pessimist and the optimist comes out again. The pessimist would, of course, say, aha, you know, this shows that helicity is not conserved. It's only an ideal fluid thing. It has no relevance in real physical systems. So, you know, this was kind of cool, but we've answered the question. Let's move on. But of course, the optimist will say, well, no, but, you know, maybe let's look at the data more carefully. Maybe we can think of something. Maybe we're just not analyzing it the right way. Like, yeah, it looks like it's all been lost, but let's see. And so to sort of think about this, what we sort of want to do is you want to go back and think about, well, what is it about a real fluid which is allowing this process to happen? What is it about a real fluid which is allowing this knot to sort of decay? And the answer is, of course, viscosity. So this is, the law of vortex evolution, okay, in an ideal fluid. And if you add viscosity to it, what you see that essentially what you're doing is you're adding a diffusion term. So what does diffusion do? Well, if you have a kind of high concentration of vorticity in a region, diffusion sort of smooths it out, and it smooths it out with a sort of characteristic time, spreads it over characteristic length, which it depends on time, is the square root of nu times t. So essentially, the simplest effect of viscosity is to take a vortex line and give it a little bit of thickness. And this is kind of like a boring effect. It doesn't do very much. It just maybe slows your ring down a little bit, right? But as you know from sort of demonstrations of vortex rings, you can make vortex rings that go over very large distances. They're doing this, and it doesn't affect them very much. On the other hand, if you have something that sort of trips itself up, or if you have two vortices interacting with each other, then you can have a situation, as you saw, where these vortex lines get very close to each other. And when they get very close to each other, these gradients get very, very large. And this actually mediates a sort of interaction. And the interaction that it mediates is a sort of reconnection. It's this process where you have this vortex line like this and this vortex line like this. They approach each other, they get close enough, and they kind of snap and reconnect. And this is the process that you've seen. Right? And this process looks as if it sort of destroys your knot, because it allows to destroy knots. And so at this point, you might say, OK, reconnections can destroy knots, so knottedness is not conserved, or helicity is not conserved. But in fact, that's not quite the full story. Right? And so what could possibly be happening? Well, what could possibly be happening is that it sort of comes from looking at this boring process over here. So if this were just a line, if this were an infinitely thin line, then this would be game over. Right? You've lost your knottedness. So end of story. But the fact that viscosity, which allows this process, also gives you a little bit of thickness, gives you, in fact, another possibility for storing structure and topology inside your vortex, which is inside the core of the vortex. So if you think about kind of from a sort of vortex line point of view what's going on, having viscosity creates this little region which is sort of rotating rigidly, okay, around your core. And if you think about the sort of vortex structure in this core, it's really, you shouldn't think of it as a single vortex line. You should think about it as a whole bundle of lines. And so essentially, this viscosity, which gives the vortex thickness, also gives it the possibility of storing internal structure. And so the real way to think about a vortex tube with finite thickness is not so much as a line, but think about it as a bundle of lines. Okay, and if you have a bundle of lines, then you can sort of twist them and twirl them around each other. And if you can sort of twirl, if you like, lines around each other, then you rapidly discover that you can, in fact, store knottedness in a line. So if you like this kind of different ways to tie a knot, one way I could tie a knot is I could take my piece of string, and I could then tie a knot in it. And I've tied my knot. But another way I could have proceeded is to cut my piece of string in two, and then I could have taken these two strands, made them nice and parallel with respect to each other. This is a model of our core. And then I can take these strands and I can twist them around each other. I'm not doing anything funny here. I'm just twisting these things around each other. So I twisted them three times. Okay, and now I'm closing them up. And what you see when you do this is that, in fact, you get the same knot. So in other words, if you have internal structure inside your tube, you can sort of twist this internal structure up. And if you look from afar, okay, it'll look like just a ring, but in fact, it's containing a knot inside it. And so you're going to have a lot of sort of knottedness and linkedness inside your ring, and so you need a way to quantify it, and that's sort of where the helicity comes in.
So you're transferring the knottedness inside.
Well, at the moment, that's a speculation. So, but what I'm saying at the moment is that there is a way of storing the knottedness inside the core. And the way to measure that is, in fact, this helicity over here. Now we have not just one line, so you can't just see immediately what the knot is. You have a bundle of lines, so you have a field, so you better sort of calculate what's going on. And the way you calculate that is using the helicity. So let me just convince you that this measure over here is in fact a quantity that measures the topological structure of the field. We've sort of been using this implicitly, but I never showed you. The simplest way to see that is to take a step back and to go to back to sort of the origins of knot theory and what Tate's kind of table generated. And look at a very simple number, right? So the simplest number that you can give a link, right, which is a good number for capturing its topology, is known as the linking number. Okay? So the whole kind of field of knot mathematics is really kind of its goal is to come up with numbers that you can ascribe to knots and links. And of course, all the only thing you're interested in is their knottedness and linkedness. So you want a number that doesn't change. However you deform this thing. You want an isotopy invariant that doesn't change unless you sort of break something. Okay, and the simplest such number is the linking number. And the nice thing about it is that you don't really need to calculate it. You can just look at a link and calculate it by inspection. And so the way, here's an example. Here we have a link between two curves. If we want to find this number, you just sort of project this link into the plane. You consider its shadow, except you keep track of who's over who. And then you go to every crossing. And at every crossing, you have kind of two vectors. And they approach this crossing in an oriented way. So you have a sign at each crossing. And so what you can do is you can sort of look at these signs, and you can add these signs up and divide by two. And what you find is an integer. It's a number. This number is the linking number. And it's an invariant under isotopies. And it's a nice exercise to sort of prove that this is it's an invariant. It's relatively straightforward, but it's also very, very powerful. So this is by inspection. So what does this have to do with the integral of the helicity that I showed before? Well, you can sort of see the connection between the two by doing a very simple thought experiment. Again, current-carrying wires and magnetic fields, nothing complicated. So you can imagine taking a current-carrying wire, okay, over here. And this wire is going to generate a magnetic field. This magnetic field goes everywhere in space. And then you can do a thought experiment. You can say, well, what if I calculated the integral of the magnetic field dotted along the tangent of some line, any other line in this field? Well, you know by the relationship between magnetic field and current, which is just the curl, and Stokes' theorem, that this integral over here is going to be simply equal to the curl of this field over here dotted with the surface. But the curl of this field over here is simply the current density, okay, and the surface is the surface over here. So what you see is that this quantity over here, what it's really doing is it's counting. It's doing something integer-like. It's counting the number of times this current-carrying wire pierces the surface. And every time it pierces, you just get the same amount of flux every time, and just the counting of this piercing over here. And so now all you need to do is you sort of need to convince yourself that if you, first of all, you can always draw this surface, okay, and that's true. That's non-trivial, but it's true. For any curve, even a complicated one, you can always find an oriented surface whose edge traces out that loop. It's known as a Seifert surface. And the other thing you need to convince yourself is that if you pull this wire through this one, changing the linking number by one, then this integral also changes by the same amount. And so it must be the same number. So essentially, this integral over here quantifies the linking between these two curves. Of course, the only thing that we used was Stokes. Right? The only thing that we used was this curl relationship between the fields. So you can do it not just with magnetic fields and current. You could do it with a vector potential and magnetic field or velocity and vorticity. And the next step is sort of almost trivial. You imagine taking this quantity over here and sort of imagine that you have a big complicated field where everything is continuous. You break it up into little vortex tubes or small loops, and then you compute this integral over here for every two of the small loops, and then you sort of average over all loops. It's not very hard to see that what's going to emerge is an expression that looks very much like the helicity. So that's sort of intuitively how you can think about the relationship between the helicity and the knottedness. Okay. So we have this quantity. We can calculate it for various configurations, and what you find very quickly is that the helicity essentially doesn't the sort of just quantifies the average linking between all pairs of vortex lines inside the fluid. And so now you can ask, okay, fine, but physically, you know, if I have a vortex, how do I know what's going on inside? How do I know what's going on outside? And because the helicity doesn't distinguish them. And so you sort of have to do something a little bit by hand. You sort of have to think about it physically and think about different ways of that this helicity can be stored. And the simplest one is if the whole tube is knotted. Okay, this is the sort of, if you like, tube linking form. The second one, you can sort of infer directly from this kind of thought experiment we did, where you twist everything up locally and you close it. Okay? But if you think about it a little bit carefully, there's in fact a third way to store it, which comes from just taking this twisted structure over here and letting it relax. And so you can imagine, if you like, a situation in which you don't have any knots or links externally. You have a tube, and this tube is coiling around in space, sort of writhing around in space. And even if you have no local twisting in this tube, the fact that the tube is sort of coiling around in space gives you, if you like, some sort of geometric phase where one of the elements of this tube sort of winds around the other one over there. So you essentially have kind of three ways, three kind of intuitive ways of storing this quantity that otherwise is agnostic as to how it's stored. Okay, so now we sort of think we know what's happening. We can go and look inside the core and see if we see any such twisting or anything such coiling. So what we did is we sort of immediately started looking at videos, and we looked at, you know, here's the reconnection, and we asked, well, can we see what's going on? This movie will pay, here we go. And one of the things that we sort of immediately saw, and the optimists get very excited at this point, is that you sort of see that there's fraying, there's sort of like twisting and coiling. So we went down this road for a long time. We tried to really kind of analyze this in detail, and it turns out it's quite difficult, right? You can sort of speculate if you like, but quantitatively it's very hard to resolve this. So we're still trying to resolve that question in detail, but what we said is, well, what can we do? Right? Because we have these traces of these vortex knots. Is there something simple that we can do that at least get us on the road to trying and figuring out what's going on? And we said, well, what information do we really have? Well, it's hard to resolve this internal twisting, but we do have the overall shape of the vortex. So can we use that to infer what's going on? And what that amounts to in practice is saying, well, we're going to ignore this twisting, this local twisting over here. We're going to make do with what we've got, and what we've got is this shape over here. And so we're going to try and quantify the helicity by these two measures over here, okay, and see what happens in the experiment. So if you like, this amounts to sort of saying that we're making the simplest assumption you can make about the internal structure, and that it is locally untwisted. Okay, so now we're going to try to infer the internal linking from the way in which these curves writhe in space, or coil in space, if you like. And just to give you a little bit of intuition about how to think about this, this image over here corresponds to a coil that looks roughly like this, and that corresponds to an amount of helicity, which is about 0.75, about 3/4. As you go all the way to this, it becomes 1, and you go all the way to this, it becomes 0. So here's an example. Here's a ring with kind of quite a few windings. There, the intermediate pitch angle that has a helicity of 3. Okay, as we come down all the way to a ring, this helicity drops all the way down to 0. Okay, so to figure this out, we really need to kind of get the three-dimensional shape of the vortex in detail. So we have a collaboration with Gordon Kindelman, and Dustin and Martin did a great job kind of adapting algorithms from medicine to really take this data set over here and make it into a three-dimensional trace. You can do this, and from this trace you can infer all sorts of properties. Okay, I think I might be running a little bit out of time. So all sorts of properties, for example, the length of these vortices, which changes dramatically during their processes. There's a sort of nice story there, but I think what I'm going to try to do is get to the main point. And the main point is now we have the three-dimensional trace of these vortices, we can quantitatively go in and see what happens to the helicity through the reconnection process. So the first thing that you sort of know already by having watched the video is that two rings become one ring. Okay? So the topological contribution to the helicity, the exterior contribution, drops dramatically from 2 down to 0. So now we can ask about the Rive contribution. This is, by the way, where the reconnection happens. Okay. Now we can ask about the Rive contribution. Well, the Rive contribution, you know, at the beginning is going to be 0 because your two circles are planar. Okay? And planar circle curves don't have any Rive to them. And in fact, what we see is that in the experiment, this Rive stays approximately 0 as you go along. Okay? And it stays 0 up until the reconnection point. And at the moment of reconnection, what we find is that the Rive jumps dramatically. Okay? And it jumps dramatically in more or less the right amount to give you the sort of appearance of, of an approximate conservation of helicity coming from just these two contributions. We still don't have the twist, but from these two contributions, there's this kind of very strong mechanism. So we were kind of puzzled by this. We were a little bit excited by this. And yeah?
It has to travel very fast through the entire vortex having the twist.
How does it happen so quickly? Excellent question. Okay, so so it's basically a simple geometric mechanism, which I'm going to try to build up in the next couple of slides. So the as you said, all the dynamics are local, right? So there's local dynamics. Nothing's really traveling around fast enough. So what could possibly be going on? Well, what we sort of found by so let's go back and look at the video. Let's look at the frames in detail, right? And so here is the vortex pair just before reconnection, and here it is just after reconnection. Here I've kind of colored them. This is green on one side and red on the other side over here. And afterwards, right, it's just one curve, so it's all red. And so what you kind of see is that, in fact, what's going on is that just the curves don't change shape almost at all, right, through this reconnection process. But at the very moment of the reconnection, what happens is what used to be two disjoint curves now becomes one big curve. So this filament approaching like this and this filament coming in like this, that used to be two circles by themselves, now get joined up. And when you join them up, what you see is that what you're doing is you're introducing a writhing turn in your vortex. So it's a very simple geometric mechanism, but it's also very, you know, by being simple, it sort of looks somewhat universal. So here you go. You have the reconnection and you introduce this. So, you know, that looked very promising. We thought this might be the right way to think about it. But then if you sort of look at this, you see that you don't quite get enough, right? Remember, this was 0.75, and we went all the way to 2. So something's sort of missing from this way of thinking. And so to try and figure out where that was coming from, we asked the question, well, can you kind of somehow take this total writhing, this total coiling, if you like, of the curve, and break it down by scale? Because this is sort of a scale that we think that we know works, but somehow at another scale, there's more. Okay? And so the way that we came up to sort of do that was to say, well, okay, it's kind of writhing is really a property of the whole curve, right? It's not a local property. So how can we give it a length scale? And the way we came up to do that was to say, well, what if we take the curve and we average the points on the curve? So we smooth the curve out and then we calculate the total writhe. And then we smooth it a little more. So here we smooth it on this scale and it gets rid of that. Okay? And we calculate the total writhe and then we smooth it a little bit more. So that got rid of that. We smooth it some more, that gets rid of this. Right? And at every step, you calculate the total writhe. Well, what you can then do is you can say, well, okay, I smooth, nothing happens. So this is now a helical vortex. I'm just showing you what happens. You can say, okay, I smoothed on this scale, nothing happened, nothing changed, nothing changed, nothing changed. At this point, the shape starts to change when I smooth it. The writhe starts to come down. And that allows me to say that, in some sense, that writhing was on that scale. And so I can construct a histogram, okay, of the writhe as a function of smoothing scale.
So it looks like Kelvin wave condensation.
Yes, exactly. So Kelvin waves, so the excitations on, there's a lot of dynamics which we don't have time to go in on this in this talk, but when you pluck vortices, right, they have these helical waves that sort of travel around, they have a dispersion relation, these are Kelvin waves, and if you like, these are in some sense large amplitude versions of these, they're Kelvin waves. Okay? So what this allows you to do, if you like, is sort of try to take a spectrum of Kelvin waves, except Kelvin waves are really only well-defined in the limit of being very, very small amplitude. And this allows you to do the whole length of the vortex. Okay, So here's another example. This is a helix. It's tightly wound, so the scale is low, okay, and the total value is high. As it becomes, as we smooth it out and sort of make curves that are less wound, you find that the total helicity kind of moves down in scale, moves up in scale and down in value. So now what we can do is we can take this and we can go and look at this reconnection event that we were looking at and see what's going on. So here we have our two strands just before the reconnection. This is our helistogram, if you like. And what you can see is it basically has no positive contributions and very, very small fluctuations, negative contributions. So this was our value of total value of sort of zero from the right and two from the topology. Just after the reconnection, right, where we sort of inferred that there had to be a big change in helicity, what we found is this is sort of how it's distributed. And so what you see is that two peaks basically appear on different length scales at the moment of reconnection. And if you go and look at the values of these length scales, what you find is that, in fact, this turn over here that we found is exactly this peak over here. So it appears at this length scale over here. But there's another peak over here, which makes up the other 1.25. And that, now we know where to look for it. It's basically on a length scale, which is the entire length of the vortex. In this case, this is millimeters, so this is actually a meter. And so as soon as you see this, you can sort of go back at the vortex and realize that the place that that is coming from is just the fact that after the reconnection, your whole vortex is sort of twisted up and right back on itself. And here what I've done is taken this whole shape after reconnection and kind of showed you the two length scales on this vortex over here. Okay. So sort of the upshot of all this is that basically what we seem to be seeing is that there's a simple geometric mechanism, okay, which kind of mediates a transfer of helicity from linking from the topology of the tubes to the writhing of these tubes in space after reconnection. And if you ignore the contribution coming from twist, which we do at the moment because we can't resolve it, it seems that through reconnections, this combination of link plus writhe is conserved. So even though your knot seems to be untying, it's really not untying, it's transferring this topology to a smaller scale. Okay, so let's see. And you can think about this in sort of almost planar terms, but I don't think I have time to go through that. Let me just ask, okay, so everything I've showed you so far was for a particular experiment, for a pair of linked rings. Is this generic, right? Is that just a special property of that experiment? So let me show you what happens for a knot. What I showed you there was for linked rings. Now we're going to see what happens for a knot. So here I'm going to show you the video. On this video, we're going to track the vortex. You're going to see the actual trace from the experimental data. And this is going to be our helistogram over here, okay? And so all our helicity is going to be appear here as a function of scale, and here I'm just measuring the contribution from the linking, the topology of the vortex. So this has a value of 2 over here to start with, and the helicity is going to appear over there. Okay, and in fact, so this is what happens. So you get, this is our trace, we approach the reconnection, bang, there's a reconnection, a peak appears, there's a second reconnection, and a second peak appears. Okay. This is exactly the sort of same dynamics that you saw for the link rings. So, yeah.
So that means reconnection is very violent in terms of the three-dimensional flow.
Yes.
Which you are not seeing.
Which we're not seeing. But from the but it's not very violent to helicity. Which is what we were surprised by. Okay. So what we can then do is we can say, okay, you know, now that we know that sort of where stuff is coming from, it's coming from these length scales over here. And this is really kind of, you know, if you look at these length scale over here, it's much more centimeter scale. It has much more to do with these little wiggles and these Kelvin waves that are propagating around. What we can do now is we can sort of take those out of the picture. We can smooth them out. And in so doing, kind of see what happens to the total helicity as a function of time through the reconnections. And so what I'm showing you over here, so in blue is the kind of total helicity, including all the little wiggles. And if you smooth just on a scale, which is, you know, if your vortex was this big, I'm now eliminating everything which is on sort of this kind of centimeter scale, very small scale, then what you find is that the total helicity, centerline helicity, this sum of kind of coiling and linking, stays rock solid, and it stays rock solid throughout both topology changes. So there's no change at all. So preliminarily, up to twist, from this, it looks like helicity is conserved through vortex reconnections. Yeah?
Sorry, so when you have reconnection,
yeah,
presumably you have a moment where sort of viscosity has, I don't know, let's say large heating effects, and then also sound dissipation. And so is a simple sort of conservation argument maybe somehow that because the sound presumably can't carry away helicity and neither can vocal beating, that it makes some sense that this is conserved? I mean,
oh, it makes some sense that this is conserved. It's not counterintuitive. I mean, well, it depends on how you think about it. Yes, it's probably something like that, but I didn't really know how to think about it until kind of really measuring it to see if it would hold or not hold, right? Because these reconnections are highly singular, and we actually still don't really know because we haven't measured the twist, and that's one thing which we're aiming to train. Right? So this is kind of like, if you like, you know, promising, right? It's not a complete story, and the fact that the twist, you know, can play a role in vortex dynamics is we know to be true. So we know that we can transfer helicity from coiling to twist. Okay. So what I want to show you next is another experiment that we did. It's an experiment with a pair of linked rings, okay, just like the one which I showed you before, but these linked rings had a different shape. And one of the things that you see in this experiment over here is that these two numbers aren't the whole story. What you can also have is the twist coming in. So let me show you the data. So this is the same sort of experiment. You have a pair of linked rings. Okay, they evolve, they reconnect twice. These are the two reconnection points. This is our topological contribution. And last time what we saw is that this other contribution was zero all the way up to here, and then it came exactly here to balance it. But in this experiment over here, what we found is this is what it did. Okay? So if I add these two together, what you see is that this centerline helicity, linking plus coiling, just quite a while before there's any reconnection, comes down and droops. Okay, at the moments of reconnection, does not jump at all. Okay, so the mechanism that conserves this quantity over here, this geometric, simple geometric mechanism of these two lines coming up anti-parallel to each other, and once they're rejoined, giving you exactly the right riding shape that compensates, still works. But the overall centerline helicity can change. And so there's a sort of simple, you know, so here's the sort of movie in all its detail, the two linked rings, a helistogram. Here you're looking at the contributions. Here you get to the reconnection. Bang, you have these two dramatic changes. The curve doesn't skip a beat, but there's this overall trend. Okay? And this overall trend is kind of simple to sort of understand, at least speculatively. It's just the transfer of coiling to twisting. So another way to kind of tie a knot, if you like, is to take your coil, okay, and sort of coil it up like this. And if I close these lines over here, I get exactly the same knot. But that's not the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that if I've coiled this thing up, so there's locally no twisting, but I have writhe, and I take this thing and I stretch it, then I can transfer this writhe to internal twist inside the core. And that's sort of what we think is going on over here. So here's a kind of simple numerical experiment where we consider a helix, and it's sort of doing what you saw at the beginning. It's leapfrogging the other one. And you can see that there's this big kind of oscillation in the centerline helicity. And what we think is happening over there is exactly what we think is happening in the experiment. There's this sort of transfer between the two. So to really resolve the kind of whole story over here, we need to measure the internal twist. Okay. What I said before is that this was hard, and it still is hard, but I just wanted to show you just one slide from some recent progress that we've made towards this. And that was sort of made by thinking about how we could measure this, and you sort of go crazy if you start thinking about measuring little strands of vortices inside vortices. As you saw before, you can't resolve pretty much a damn thing. So we went back to the definition of helicity, the quantity that we actually really want to measure. And you can see from this that this kind of, it suggests a very simple way of measuring the internal twist. The helicity is big when there's a velocity, a flow along the vortex. And that's sort of simple to think about. The fluid is spinning around. You add a flow like this, that makes the sort of fluid spin around like this. So if you could go inside the core and you could measure velocity fields along the core, then you could tell the difference between this and this. And so what we've been doing in the last kind of few months is taking the first steps towards trying to do this. What I'm going to show you now is a sort of preliminary experiment. You see over here a vortex. It has a single turn on it. And you're going to see in a minute that what we did is put little blobs of dye inside the core of this vortex at regular spacings around this vortex. And these blobs of dye, they're inside the core. So by tracking them, we think we can track what's going on inside the core. And what we see is that, indeed, there's stuff going on inside the core. You can see that there's these flows that sort of come in and come back. There's a whole sort of breathing dynamics inside the core of the vortex. So the decay, so it depends a little bit on how it's stored. So you can make an estimate, and the estimate suggests that basically when it is stored as local twist, it decays with maximal velocity. But whenever it's stored in non-local twist, then it decays very slowly. So in fact, we think that, you know, the fact that it seems to be stored mostly non-locally after the reconnection, at least in the link ring case, suggests that then it is actually conserved completely because the decay will be slow. But we don't know that. It's a difficult question. Okay, so I think I'm probably out of time, so I won't tell you very much about this. What I was going to say next was just that another question you can ask is, how universal is this, right? Does this just apply? It's a simple geometric mechanism, right? So the first thing you want to do is sort of kick it by looking at different systems, okay? You want to look at magnetic reconnections, but that's kind of hard. The other thing you can look at is superfluids that you heard a lot about yesterday from Russ and Carlo. And in fact, round about at the same time that we were sort of doing these experiments, there was a sort of beautiful paper that came out by this fellow over here, Davide Proment, together with Miguel Onorato and Carlo Barenghi, in which they did a sort of simulation, a Gross-Peterski simulation of a vortex. And this was kind of tricky. They had to come up with an initial state construction that gave you this vortex. But what they saw was dynamics that look sort of remarkably similar to the ones which we see in the viscous vortex case. So we sort of started up a collaboration. Davide sort of taught us a little bit how to do Gross-Peterski. We kind of came up with another method to generate initial states that sort of allows you to make arbitrary vortex configurations. I don't have time to go into that. What I want to show you is that basically what we're finding is that a lot of the dynamics, when you compare them very carefully, such as the change in length of the vortex, for example, as a function of time, seem to be very similar across the two systems. And in fact, so is the mechanism of helicity conservation. So in this case over here, you can see this is the movie for the superfluid simulation. You can see all this helicity which appears after the reconnection, and it's distributed in a slightly different way as the fluid vortex case. But basically, numerically, it works out that in the approximation that your core is very small compared to your overall scale, the same mechanism comes in, and the same mechanism gives you an overall conservation.
Is there an analog to the drift contribution here in
superfluid? No. So you can't store internal structure. That's why there's a drop. So you can do scaling on that drop. We can talk about this later if you like. You can do scaling. You see roughly 1/r scaling of core size to vortex size of this drop over here. OK. So I think I'm out of time. So all I'm going to say is, where are we going next? Well, one thing is we want to sort of push this technique for vortex generation and see whether or not it's really true that we can kind of pattern an arbitrary vortex shape in three dimensions. I hope I've convinced you we've sort of been able to use this to make vortex knots and make some first steps in establishing the conservation of helicity in an experiment. And of course, the next sort of stage for us is, of course, to kind of resolve these twist questions in details, look at helicity conservations on all scales. Okay. Vortex engineering, but the next sort of steps that we want to take are, of course, like a lot of what you saw, right, is that you have this kind of other quantity, which is conserved, and it goes from this big scale, which is a topological scale, through reconnections to smaller scales, right, and you know what that reminds you of course. We want to sort of start to see whether in practice any of these ideas and results from these experiments can help you interpret and understand what's going on in the more complicated problem. So that's all I have to say. I should thank sort of all members of the group, in particular these two fellows over here, Dustin Kleckner and Martin Schieler, who you've seen, whose work you've seen in this talk. And in particular, there's one other kind of member of the group that's working a lot on these ideas, which is Sridesh Kedia. He's a theorist. I didn't have time to tell you any about this, but he's been finding sort of, if you like, he's been working on the counterpart of the viscous fluid case. He's been working on the ideal fluid case, but not the ideal fluid in the sense of a superfluid, the ideal fluid in the sense of kind of Maxwell's equations in free space. And we don't have time to talk about this today, but it turns out in sort of free space, you can find solutions to Maxwell's equations that are similar in spirit to vortex knots. They encode knots. Okay, these are magnetic field lines of a beam of light, and these knots are perfectly preserved, and they last forever. And the nice thing about this arena is that you can actually do analytics there. So these are analytical calculations. I'm just sort of plotting them over here. But I think that's all we have time for, so thank you for your attention.